Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 8, which I will entitle Four Abominations in the Temple. Here's a brief introduction to the chapter. The connected visions between Ezekiel 3, verse 12, and Ezekiel 7, verse 27, which we have just previously covered, those visions comprehended the people in Jerusalem and the Jews in Babylon, both places. But now the visions between Ezekiel 8, verse 1, and 11, verse 25, those visions refer immediately to Jerusalem, not to the exiles, but to the people in Jerusalem. And more precisely, Ezekiel 8, 1 through Ezekiel 11, 25, those verses refer to the remnant of Judah under Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. This is as distinguished from the Babylonian exiles. So let's begin in Ezekiel 8, 1. In the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day, while I was sitting in my house, and the elders of Judah were sitting before me, the hand of the sovereign Lord came upon me there. The elders of Judah, we see that Ezekiel was a well-known, prominent prophet to have the elders with him in his house there. This was in the sixth year, verse 1 says, sixth year of what? That's the sixth year of the captivity of Jehoiachin, who ruled between 598 and 597. Jehoiachin was carried off to Babylon in 597 at the same time that Ezekiel was, so it makes sense that Ezekiel starts numbering from that year. So if Jehoiachin was carried off and Ezekiel was carried off in 597, and this is the sixth year, so we're roughly talking about 591 BC. This is not too far from the fall of Jerusalem in 586 and the siege of Jerusalem, which began in 588. It's in the sixth month of the year. That's the month of Elul, which is August and September on our calendar. Ezekiel's sitting in his house. He's sitting. Now, remember in chapter 4, he had been lying on his left side for 390 days, on his right side for 40 days, and the lying on his side symbolized in some fashion the captivity of the people of Israel. But now he's sitting up. He's teaching and instructing the people. And teaching was frequently done sitting by the Jews. He's in his house. That's the same house by the river Chebar, which I talked about in Ezekiel chapter 1. That river that ran between the Tigris and the Euphrates River in present-day eastern Syria. Ezekiel was teaching in his house because there was no temple now because they're in Babylon, not in Jerusalem. And there was no synagogue either because they were in exile. So he's teaching in his house. And these elders, we will presume, are the leaders of the exiles, the elders of Judah that were carried captive along with Jehoiachin and Ezekiel in 597. We go now to Ezekiel 8, verses 2 through 4. I looked, says Ezekiel, and I saw a figure like that of a man. From what appeared to be his waist down, he was like fire, and from there up his appearance was as bright as glowing metal. He stretched out what looked like a hand and took me by the hair of my head. The Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, and in visions of God he took me to Jerusalem, to the entrance to the north gate of the inner court, where the idol that provokes to jealousy stood. And there before me was the glory of the God of Israel, as in the vision I had seen in the plain. Now in verse 2, Ezekiel sees the figure like that of a man. It doesn't say he saw a man, but a figure that appeared to be a man. I'm going to assume this is Jesus. It was usual for the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, to appear in human form before the incarnation. Even though this was in the Son's pre-incarnate state, he still appeared like a man. Now, that's debatable, of course, but that's the way I'm going to take it. I think that's reasonable. And as Ezekiel looked at this man from the waist down was like fire. That's why he didn't say he looked like a man, because most men don't have fire from their waist down. It was close enough to look like a man, but it was a special sort of man. He was on fire from his waist down. And from his waist up, he was bright like glowing metal. So he was burning and bright. Now here are some options, all of which are not mutually exclusive, as to what the symbolism might mean. That fire and that brightness. The light of grace communicated from Christ to his people. The love of Christ. The zeal for God and his house. God's wrath against an idolatrous nation. God's incomprehensible majesty and glory, his glory being the glory of the only begotten, the brightness of his Father's glory, and the express image of his person, talking about Jesus here. Now, there are some other visions in the scriptures describing Jesus in a similar way. We see in Revelation 1:15, and his, this is the NAS, in Revelation 1:15, in the NASB translation, and his, capital H, Jesus, and Jesus' feet were like burnished bronze. In other words, they were shining. Burnished bronze when it has been caused to glow in a furnace. And in Ezekiel 1, verse 27, we read this, "Then I noticed from the appearance of his loins and upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw something like fire. And there was a radiance around him." So brightness and fire, waist up, waist down. This is Jesus, the same Jesus that Ezekiel earlier saw when he was at the river Chebar in chapter 1. In verse 3, Ezekiel 8, "God stretched out what looked like a hand," or actually it was the figure like a man, Jesus, "stretched out what looked like a hand and took me by the hair of my head." Interesting way to travel in a vision. "The Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, and in visions of God he took me to Jerusalem." Now at this point, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown has an interesting comment, that commentary does, on the difference between the attitudes of the people in Babylon, the exiles, and the remaining Jews in Jerusalem. Here's what they say, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, quote, "The exiles looked hopefully towards Jerusalem, and so far from believing things there to be on the verge of ruin, expected a return in peace, while those left in Jerusalem eyed the exiles with contempt, as if cast away from the Lord, whereas they themselves were near God and insured in the possessions of the land." In other words, it didn't matter whether you were a Jew in exile in Babylon or a Jew in Jerusalem. You had a bad attitude, a wrong attitude. The exiles needed to realize they weren't going back to Jerusalem, and the people in Judah were still sinning terribly, full of idolatry. Now, we read in Ezekiel 11:15 a verse which shows the attitude of the people in Jerusalem toward the exiles. "Son of man, your brothers, your relatives, your fellow exiles in the whole house of Israel, all of them, are those to whom the inhabitants of Jerusalem have said, 'Go far from the Lord, this land has been given us as a possession.'" Jerusalem may have been taken by the Babylonians in 597, but the old Jewish idea of the land died hard. We have the land is ours. God gave it to us. God wouldn't take it away from us. Well, they are going to be disabused of that erroneous notion in just a few years, in 586 BC. Now, continuing in Ezekiel 8, verse 3, Jesus, the man, stretched out what looked like a hand, took him by the hair of the head, took Ezekiel to Jerusalem. This is in a vision, and more particularly in Jerusalem, Jesus took Ezekiel to the entrance to the north gate of the inner court. Now, there are a lot of descriptions of places in Ezekiel 8, and a lot of them are controversial and difficult. I've pictured these places the best I have been able to do, and I will try to describe them to you, realizing, of course, I could be wrong. The commentators differ all over the place at various aspects of this sort of description. Well, let's take this first place, the north gate of the inner court. Well, first of all, what is the inner court? Remember Solomon's temple, and we are now describing Solomon's temple. This is Ezekiel's vision. Herod's temple hadn't been built yet, of course. That didn't start happening till 520, 516, when the second temple was built. And then, of course, later on, Herod added on to it. But this is Solomon's temple we're talking about here, the first temple. There were two courts described in the book of Kings. There was the inner court and the outer court. The inner court is the court of the priest, as Barnes, Benson, and Ellicott say. And the outer court was where everybody else but the priest could go into. Now, Ezekiel is taken to the northern gate. There were gates on all four sides of the temple courtyard, and so there were gates on the northern side. That would be the direction from which Ezekiel would arrive from Babylon, so that makes sense. Now, I have a schematic, a diagram, a floor plan, if you will, of the temple that existed during the time of Herod. Herod, of course, added on to the second temple, which is rebuilt by Ezra, 520 to 516. And so we've got to be careful to not confuse the temples. But the diagram I have has a court of women in it. And Wikipedia, interestingly enough, says that, quote, "There are sources which say that the court of women existed even in the tabernacle at Shiloh and in the first temple," that's Solomon's temple. All right, if we make that assumption, and again, it's not in the scriptures, this is an assumption, that we have a court of women, which then, as you go up the curved steps toward the bronze altar, you go up the steps and you end up in the court of the men. You go from the court of women up to the court of the men, and then there's a low balustrade there. You look over that balustrade, and you are into the court of the priest where the bronze altar is. And after the bronze altar, as you go west, you end up in the temple. All right, well, on the northern side, if you go west far enough to go past the court of women, you go to a gate that is parallel with the bronze altar. That's where most probably Ezekiel was carried to in his vision. This is most probably where the so-called idol of jealousy is located. Right as you go up the steps through the gate, as soon as you enter into the courtyard, there was an idol there. The idol of jealousy, or as the NIV translates it, the idol that provokes to jealousy. Of course, God is a jealous God. He often presents his relationship metaphorically with Israel as a husband and a wife. He doesn't like Israel's spiritual adultery, and so here's an example of that. And that, of course, would make God a jealous God because his people are whoring around. Now, what that idol was is not stated. It was some kind of graven image. It could be Baal, Mars, Tammuz, Adonis, Astarte, some kind of idol that was popular back then. I mentioned that it provoked the Lord to jealousy. We read in Deuteronomy 32, verse 21, "They have made me jealous with what is not God." Now in verse 4, we see that right there at the spot where that idol was, that jealousy-provoking idol, we see the glory of God was there too. Verse 4, "And there before me," Ezekiel says, "was the glory of the God of Israel, as in the vision I had seen in the plain." So the Shekinah glory had not left the temple yet, at least in the vision. It's ironic that the glory of God would be there where all this idolatry was. The glory of God, the Shekinah glory, was there probably because God was about to destroy the idols. The glory of God was there in anger. Now, this glory that Ezekiel saw, this brightness, is the same glory that Ezekiel saw when he had the vision in the plain. Now, what's he talking about there? That was the vision that Ezekiel had in Ezekiel 3. So now he's having a vision in his house, as we said. He's in his house now. In Ezekiel 8, he has a vision of the glory of God. This is the same glory that he had in his plain vision, which was in Ezekiel 3, verse 22 through 23. "And the hand of the Lord was on me there, and he said to me, 'Get up, go out to the plain, and there I will speak to you.'" This is some area by the river, I'm sure, or out beyond the river, where it's flat. "So I got up and went out to the plain, and behold, the glory of the Lord was standing there like the glory which I saw by the river Chebar, and I fell on my face." All right, so he's seen the glory of God in his house. He's seen the glory of God in the plain, and he mentions that the glory was the same in the plain as it was by the river Chebar. We read about that in Ezekiel 1:3. "The word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar. And there the hand of the Lord came upon him." And dropping down to verse 28 of Ezekiel 1, "As the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Bright, shining radiance there by the river Chebar." So basically, Ezekiel's had three visions now. Chapter 1 by the river Chebar. In chapter 3, he has a vision in the plain, and now in chapter 8, he has a vision in his house, but he's seeing the same glory. Again, the idea is you don't mess with God. You don't hold up idols in the face of a glorious God. We go now to Ezekiel 8, verse 5. "Then he," that's the man with all the glory, i.e. Jesus, "then he said to me, 'Son of man, look toward the north.' So I looked, and in the entrance north of the gate of the altar, I saw this idol of jealousy." Now here, Jesus calls Ezekiel son of man. He uses this phrase all the way through. Ezekiel does, uses this phrase all the way through his book. Two speculations on that. Some people say that he is called the son of man, Ezekiel is, so that Ezekiel would be humble because a man's characteristics are such that he is finite. On the other hand, some people say that Ezekiel is a type of Christ because he's preaching to an unbelieving nation, even as Jesus did, and since Jesus knows the future, he knows that Ezekiel is going to be a type of what's coming in the future, the Messiah, and so he calls Ezekiel the Son of Man. Jesus tells Ezekiel to look toward the north. He means look toward the northern edge of the temple. He's in the courtyard now, I assume, so he says look back toward the north gate. And so Ezekiel looked, and in the entrance north of the gate of the altar I saw this idol of jealousy. So here are how things were arranged in the courtyard here. Directly in front of the holy place of the temple was Ahaz's idolatrous fake altar of burnt offering. We read about that in 2 Kings 16, verse 14. And the bronze altar which was before the Lord, he, that's Ahaz, brought from the front of the house, from between his altar, Ahaz's altar, and the house of the Lord, and he put it on the north side of his altar. So if you'll picture running from west to east, the temple itself, the building, and then you see the bronze altar, the true altar, and then you go east a little further, and you have Ahaz's fake altar. Now Ahaz takes the bronze altar, which is in between the temple and the fake altar, and Ahaz moves it to the north toward the outer wall of the inner court, and also even with Ahaz's altar. So now you have the altar, the bronze altar, near the wall towards the north of Ahaz's fake altar. Now there's a gate there in that wall, and near the steps, as you go up the steps into the inner court, the court of the priest, there was this idol that provoked to jealousy. It was just to the north of Ahaz's fake altar of burnt offering, right as you come up the steps. This jealousy-provoking idol is said to be in the entrance. That would be in the entranceway of the gate of the altar. That's the gate that opens up on that fake altar. It also opens up on the true altar, too, because the fake altar and the true bronze altar were in a line, and the gate opened up to those altars. So going from south to north, you have the fake altar, you have the bronze altar, and then you have the idol provoking jealousy. Pretty disgusting. Now, just a minute ago, I assumed that Ezekiel was standing in the courtyard looking north toward the gateway in the outer wall, but actually you could read the north in verse 5 in a different way. Jesus says to Ezekiel, "Son of man, look toward the north." In other words, look toward the northern end of the entranceway. And Ezekiel could still be standing outside the wall. We're not going to quibble on that, of course. This is the first place of idolatry in this chapter, in the temple. The first place at the northern gate of the altar. We go now to Ezekiel 8, verses 6 through 8. And he, that's Jesus, said to me, that's Ezekiel, "Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The utterly detestable things the house of Israel is doing here, things that will drive me far from my sanctuary. But you will see things that are even more detestable." So Jesus is going to move Ezekiel from the jealousy-provoking idol at the northern altar gate, and he's going to go to place number 2 of idolatry. Verse 7, "Then he," that's Jesus, "brought me," Ezekiel, "to the entrance to the court." Now, I'm going to assume here that this is the entrance to the court of the priest. Verse 7 just says entrance to the court. It doesn't say which court, but I'm going to assume it's the court of the priest. And at the court of the priest, as you go from the court of the priest, as you go from the court of women, assuming there's a court of women there, there's the Nicanor Gate, some 12 steps that were curved. You walk through the Nicanor Gate and you go up. You walk through the Nicanor Gate and you go up to the court of the men, the court of Israel it's also called. You look over a balustrade and you look into the court of the priest. Again, this is a little bit anachronistic. This is Herod's court I'm talking about. But assuming that it looked something like that in the time of Solomon, which I think is a reasonable supposition, I don't know, I'm not a temple expert. But even if the court of women wasn't there, there had to be an entrance to the court of the priest. And Ezekiel looked at that entrance and he saw a hole in the wall. As the wall went around, we're going to assume there's a building there. Now, at this point, I must say, the speculations as to what the physical arrangement of the temple was that Ezekiel describes here in his vision, the speculations are limitless. The commentators split all over the place, so I'm just going to give you my take on it, realizing, of course, it's probably wrong, but it's just as good as anybody else's. We're going to take this hole that's in the wall. This is going to be a hole in the wall of the meeting room where the elders of Israel would meet. Now, one commentator I saw said that was the Sanhedrin. Another commentator, I think it was Ellicott, said, no, the Sanhedrin did not exist until after the return from the exile. So we're just going to say it's a meeting room. Ezekiel looks through the hole at the gate there, and he sees a doorway on another wall of that meeting room. He's got to dig through the hole because it's too small to get into. He goes through, and through the doorway that he sees on another wall, wherever it is, maybe the opposite wall, maybe on a side wall, that doorway opens up into the priest's living quarters. And in the living quarters, Ezekiel sees all of the idolatrous images on the walls that we are going to look at in just a minute. So, going back to Ezekiel 8, verse 7, I looked and I saw a hole in the wall. Verse 8, he, that's Jesus, said to me, said to Ezekiel, son of man, now dig into the wall. So I dug into the wall and saw a doorway there. Now again, this is all in a vision. So we go now to Ezekiel 8, verses 9 through 11. And he, that's Jesus, said to me, go in and see the wicked and detestable things they are doing here. So I went in and looked, and I saw portrayed all over the walls all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals and all the idols of the house of Israel. In front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel, and Jaazaniah, son of Shaphan, was standing among them. Each had a censer in his hand, and a fragrant cloud of incense was rising. So now we are looking into the rooms of the priests and the Levites, which were built all along the wall of the inner court, in the outer court, but along the wall of the inner court. Now we can deduce that as Ezekiel looks through the doorway, that he sees not just one chamber, not one living chamber of the priest, but many. We read in verse 12 of this chapter 8, then he, that's Jesus, said to me, son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the darkness, each at the shrine of his idol? Sounds like there are 70 elders with 70 shrines. And so we're going to take it that way, that there are lots of rooms. 70 rooms would be an awful lot. Of course, the priests could be doubled up. They might have roommates. I don't know whether that's feasible or not to have 70 rooms, but I'm going to assume there's more than one room there because we have all these shrines, each at the shrine of his idol. It sounds like more than one idol, more than one shrine, more than one bedroom. Now, on the walls of these bedrooms, in verse 10, we see crawling creatures. Adam Clark says that these crawling creatures probably represent Egyptian idols. Clark says we see Egyptian idols in verses 6 through 12 in this chapter, Phoenician idols in verses 13 and 14, and Persian idols in verses 15 and 16. But I suspect that's speculative, and I don't really care. The point is there were idols everywhere. So in verse 11, in front of them, in front of all these pictures, stood the 70 elders. Now, first question, how could 70 elders fit into a series of priest quarters? I already mentioned the problem. Here's what Ellicott says about that. There may have been no enclosed chamber about the courts of the temple capable of actually containing so large a number. But again, we are to remember that as this is in vision and for purposes of instruction, it is not necessary that all the details should be actually possible. And that's perfectly true. This is a vision. But if you want to be more precise about it, I speculate that you could have one elder in one room with one idol in each room. As I mentioned, verse 12, the elders are standing each at the shrine of his idol. And I also mentioned you could double up. You have two priests in one room or even three priests in one room with three idols in one room. Doesn't really matter. The point is this gross idolatry going on. Adam Clark says, as to why there are 70 elders, Adam Clark says the Sanhedrin, or Great Jewish Council, consisting of 70 or 72 persons, six chosen out of every tribe, as representatives of the people, that this is what the 70 represents. But remember now, as Ellicott says, the Sanhedrin wasn't created until after the exile, so I have trouble seeing how the 70 elders represent the Sanhedrin. Well, here are some options as to why 70 elders. Ellicott mentions option number one. The 70 refers to the 70 men chosen to enjoy the theophany with Moses at Mount Sinai. We read about that in Exodus 24, verses 9 and 10. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of Israel's elders, and they saw the God of Israel. Beneath his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire stone as clear as the sky itself. So that's a famous story. In Exodus, Moses went up on Mount Sinai with 70 elders. Option number two, this is also from Ellicott. This 70 elders could refer to the 70 men who were chosen to share with Moses his judicial burdens. We read about this in Numbers 11, verses 16 through 17. The Lord answered Moses, "Bring me 70 men from Israel, known to you as elders and officers of the people. Take them to the tent of meeting and have them stand there with you. Then I will come down and speak with you there. I will take some of the spirit who is on you and put the spirit on them. They will help you bear the burden of the people so that you do not have to bear it by yourself." So this would be 70 judges. And of course, the 70 could refer to both the 70 elders that ruled Israel in Exodus 24 and the 70 judges who helped Moses judge in Numbers 11. And of course, there's also the possibility, I think, that the 70 could refer to the same group of people. In Exodus 24, it's 70 elders, but in Numbers 11, it's the same 70 judges. The 70 probably refers to both, at least Adam Clark says. So he says, quote, "the origination of which we find in the 70 elders, representatives of the congregation, who went up with Moses to the mount to behold the glory of Jehovah," that's the first 70, "and to witness the secret transactions relating to the establishment of the covenant," still that's the first 70. Also, second 70, "in the 70 elders appointed to share the burden of the people with Moses." So Adam Clark says, I think that's reasonable. Now, one comment about these 70 elders, it was especially bad that the civil magistrates, the chief rulers, and the governors were given to idolatry, as John Gill points out. And in addition to that, they were in the chambers of the priests and Levites, where they weren't supposed to be, because they weren't priests and they weren't Levites. They were political people, 70 elders. They weren't priests, but they were in, well, either they were in rooms right on the inside of the inner court where they weren't supposed to be. They could be on the outside, on the outer court, which I suggested earlier, so we're not going to get them for that. But the idolatry is terrible, and they're the leaders of Israel, and to whom much has been given, much is required. Now, a particular elder, Jazaniah, son of Shaphan, was standing among them. Adam Clark says of this Shaphan, or Shaphan, I don't know how to pronounce his name. Shaphan was a scribe, or what some call comptroller of the temple in the days of Josiah, and Jazaniah, his son, probably succeeded him in this office. Remember, Josiah died in 609. We're now in 591, so we're not talking about too far away. Jazaniah was the head of this band of idolaters. So we move now to Ezekiel 8, verses 12 through 15. He, that's Jesus, said to me, Ezekiel, "Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the darkness, each at the shrine of his own idol? They say, 'The Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land.' Again," he said, "you will see them doing things that are even more detestable." Then he brought me to the entrance to the north gate of the house of the Lord, and I saw women sitting there mourning for Tammuz. He said to me, "Do you see this, son of man? You will see things that are even more detestable than this." Now, in verse 12, we're still talking about the second place of idolatry at the eastern gate to the court of the priest, probably in the priest quarters, 70 elders committing idolatry. Why were they doing it in the darkness? Well, because they were ashamed of what they were doing. Each of them, as I said earlier, in verse 12, were at the shrine of his own idol. They had their own personal idol. And they say, "God doesn't see us. We're in the dark. God, even though he's omnipotent, he can't see everything. And it's obvious that the Lord has forsaken the land." And now notice when things go wrong, how quick people are to blame God. Things were not going well in Judah. You got the 597 exile, for example. And so the elders that are remaining in Jerusalem say, "Yahweh has forsaken us. Things are not going well. So we'll have to turn to some other gods to take care of us." And of course, they didn't think that perhaps things were not going well was because of the people's gross sin. So I guess they were right in saying that the Lord had forsaken the land. Yes, he had, but they didn't understand there was a reason for it. Their own sins, their idolatry. Now, Jesus tells Ezekiel in verse 13, "I'm going to show you some things that are even more detestable than these 70 elders." So we move now to place number 3 in the temple where idolatry was being carried out. In verse 14, then Jesus brought Ezekiel to the entrance to the north gate of the house of the Lord. Now, we've already talked about the north gate. That's where the jealousy-provoking idol was located, right to the north of the bronze altar, which had been moved up toward the northern wall by Ahaz. So we now need to talk about where this north gate is. Option number 1, this northern gate in verse 14 is the same northern gate that was mentioned in verse 3, where the jealousy-provoking idol was. This is Barnes' suggestion. Option number 2, This northern gate of verse 14 is a gate to the west of the gate where the jealousy idol was, mentioned in verse 3. This is Lightfoot's opinion, the famous Lightfoot. So it would be the westernmost northern gate, and it would open up onto the courtyard, and as you walk through the courtyard, you'd hit the wall of the temple. Whereas the easternmost northern gate of verse 3, according to this option, was opposite the bronze altar, so that when you went in that gate, after you got past the jealousy-provoking idol, you would hit the bronze altar. I don't think it really matters, but just to keep things separate in our minds, I'm going to take Lightfoot's position on this and say that this was a second northern gate, westernmost northern gate opposite the temple. Now, John Gill's got another option. He says it's the gate called Teri or Teddy. I'm sure because the Resh and the Dalet in Hebrew look just alike, so you don't know whether it's Teri or Teddy. This gate was very little used, Gill says, in this part of the temple where the sacrifice offered, and therefore it was the greater abomination to commit idolatry where the Lord was more solemnly worshipped. So this particular gate is close to that bronze altar. Gill says this, these women worshipping Tammuz, they were not in the court of the women where they should have been, but at the northern gate near the place of sacrifice. And they were sitting there, which none but the kings of the house of Judah and the family of David were allowed in the temple. Well, I don't know whether Gill is right or not. I do notice that he assumes there's a court of the women there. As I said, that's kind of interesting because in Solomon's temple, in the scripture at least, there's no mention of a court of women. I guess Gill assumes that there's other evidence for that. All right, so that's enough of that. We're just going to assume that this is the third place of idolatry. It's the second northern gate. Now, there are probably not women inside the court of the priest at this northern gate. They're probably outside the door down the steps because women were not allowed into the court of the priest. Actually, non-priests were not allowed in the court of the priest either. So these women are probably outside at the door. Now, in verse 14, these women are said to be mourning for their idol, Tammuz. Now, Tammuz is nowhere else mentioned in the scripture, according to Ellicott. But here's some options as to who Tammuz was. Adonis, the Greek god Adonis, is option number one. This is mentioned by Ellicott. Now, who is this Adonis? John Gill says, who also agrees that Tammuz is Adonis. Adonis was a young man beloved by Venus, and being killed by a boar, his death was lamented by her. And in respect to the goddess, an anniversary solemnity was kept by men and women lamenting his death, especially by women. So Pausanias, speaking of a certain place there, says he, the women of the Argives, a people in Greece, mourn for Adonis. Lucian gives a particular account of this ceremony as performed at Byblus, a city in Phoenicia, not far from Judea, from whence the Jews might have borrowed this custom. I have seen, says he, says Lucian, in Byblus a large temple of Venus Biblia, where they performed the rites unto Adonis, and I was a spectator of them. The Biblians say the affair relating to Adonis or his death by a boar happened in their country, and in memory of it every year they beat themselves, lament, and offer sacrifice. And great mourning goes through the whole country, and when they beat themselves and mourn, they sacrifice to Adonis as dead, but the day following they pretend he is alive, and they shave their heads as the Egyptians do at the death of Apis. So if Tammuz is Adonis, he was killed by a boar, and so that explains why everybody's mourning for him. Now Adonis, of course, is not a god, but the rituals are all associated with idolatry, because Adonis was beloved by Venus, of course, the goddess of lust. Adam Clark, who also thinks that this Tammuz is Adonis, says that Adonis is fabled to have been a beautiful youth beloved by Venus and killed by a wild boar in Mount Lebanon, whence springs the river Adonis, which was fabled to run blood at his festival in August. The women of Phoenicia, Assyria, and Judea worshipped him as dead with deep lamentation, wearing priapi and other obscene images all the while. Those are fake phalluses wrapped around their waist. And they prostituted themselves in honor of this idol, having for some time mourned him as dead. They then supposed him revivified and broke out into the most extravagant rejoicings. Of the appearance of the river at this season, Mr. Mondrell thus speaks, "We had the good fortune to see what is the foundation of the opinion which Lucian relates, that this stream at certain seasons of the year, especially about the feast of Adonis, is of a bloody color, proceeding from a kind of sympathy, as the heathens imagined, for the death of Adonis, who was killed by a wild boar in the mountain out of which this stream issues. Something like this we saw actually come to pass, for the water was stained to a surprising redness, as we observed in traveling, had stained the sea a great way into a reddish hue. This was no doubt occasioned by a red ochre, over which the river ran with violence at this time of its increase. I guess ochre is some kind of red algae. But anyway, it's kind of interesting. This mourning for Adonis is very well known in the pagan world, and apparently the Jewish women had picked that up, and so they're mourning for their dead Adonis who was killed by a boar. Verse 15, God says to Ezekiel, Jesus says to Ezekiel, "Do you see this, son of man? You will see things that are even more detestable than this." So we move now from the third place of idolatry in the temple, and we go to the fourth place. But before we do, let me make one other point. In verse 14, we see these women that are mourning for Tammuz. They're sitting there. Many commentators think that these women were also prostituting themselves, because that was the sort of thing often done by Tammuz worshippers. The Cambridge commentator says that these women were either outside the gate, which I've already mentioned, but there might have been some chambers built on the sides of the outer gateway, and that's where the women could engage in their trade of prostitution. We go to Ezekiel 8, verses 16 through 18. He, that's Jesus, then brought me, Ezekiel, into the inner court of the house of the Lord, and there at the entrance to the temple, between the portico and the altar, were about 25 men. With their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, they were bowing down to the sun in the east. He, that's Jesus, said to Ezekiel, "Have you seen this, son of man? Is it a trivial matter for the house of Judah to do the detestable things they are doing here? Must they also fill the land with violence and continually provoke me to anger? Look at them putting the branch to their nose. Therefore I will deal with them in anger. I will not look on them with pity or spare them. Although they shout in my ears, I will not listen to them." Preliminary application point. You want God to listen to you? You better not be committing idolatry, because he's not going to listen to you. Now, this fourth place, where is it? This is easy. Between the portico, that's the famous porch on Solomon's temple, in front of which were the two columns, Boaz and Joachim. And then as you go east from the portico, you end up at the bronze altar. Of course, the bronze altar has been moved up to the north, so now it's the fake altar of Ahaz that's there. And between the portico and the fake bronze altar of Ahaz, 25 men were standing in that space. They were looking toward the east, toward the gate of the inner court, which opened up into the outer court, and they were bowing down to the sun. Now, this place between the porch, the portico of the temple, and the bronze altar, in this case the fake bronze altar, but normally the bronze altar would be there, that place between the porch and the bronze altar was a very sacred place. It was reckoned more holy than the court of the priest, even. Well, it was in the court of the priest, but it was the most holy place in the court of the priest. John Gill quotes a rabbi to that effect. Now, these 25 idolaters were staring out the eastern door, staring toward the east. John Gill says that the sanctuary was built to the west. As you go in the door, you're facing west to get to the sanctuary. That in their worship the Jews might not look to the east, as the Gentiles did. Wherefore these men, these 25 men, that they might imitate the Gentiles in their idolatry, turned their backs to the most holy place. Good symbolism there that John Gill picked up. They're worshiping the sun. We see that this was forbidden in the law. Deuteronomy 4:19, "And beware lest you lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, and be drawn away and worship them and serve them." Deuteronomy 17, verses 2 through 3. "If there is found in your midst, in any of your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God by transgressing his covenant, and is gone and served other gods and worshiped them," or the sun, or the moon, or any of the heavenly host. So you see the heavenly bodies are put on the same par with your typical animal-type idols, carved in wood and covered with gold and silver. We see the evil king Manasseh of the southern kingdom of Judah engaged in sun worship, 2 Kings 21, verses 3 through 5. For he, referring to Manasseh, who ruled between 687 and 642, He rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and he erected altars for Baal and made an Asherah, as Ahab king of Israel had done. And he worshipped all the host of heaven. Now, usually you think of host of heaven as stars, but think about it. The sun is a star, and that's included in the host of heaven. And so Ahab was a sun worshiper too. And so Manasseh was a sun worshiper too. Manasseh built altars in the house of the Lord. He built altars for all the host of heaven. A star worshiper. Put the altars right there in the holy temple of God. Well, not only were these four different occasions of idolatry going on, but the house of Judah was also filling the land with violence, as Jesus says in verse 17. And then he says to Ezekiel, look at these 25 men. They're putting the branch to their nose. Now, this is a strange expression. Barnes says, quote, this is an allusion to a then familiar practice of which we find no clear traces elsewhere. And Ellicott agrees with that. In other words, we're not going to know exactly what kind of pagan ritual is being involved here. John Gill says, quote, a laurel or olive or vine branch, which idolaters carried in their hands and put to their nose in honor of the idol they worshipped. Well, that's reasonable speculation, I guess. Adam Clark says, quote, that the heathens carried branches of trees in their sacred ceremonies is well known to all persons acquainted with classic antiquity, and it is probable that the heathen barred those from the use of such branches in the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles. Well, again, that's a origin speculation. I don't know. So we don't know what this branch to the nose is, but I've got to mention this, some Jewish interpretations of this. Adam Clark says, quote, there are many strange and some filthy interpretations given of this clause, but the former are not worth repeating, the strange interpretations, and the filthy interpretations I abominate too much to submit to defile my paper with them. Well, that excited my curiosity. So I looked a little bit further. I got a quotation from Benson. He says that some Jewish commentators think that the Hebrew word translated as branch is rather a foul-smelling odor. So then, at the end of verse 17, we would read, look at them putting the foul-smelling odor to their nose. Well, what would this foul-smelling odor be? John Gill says that it could be the incense which they offered up to their idols. Well, that's not too filthy for Adam Clark not to mention it, but the other possibility is that the ill smell arose from the posteriors of these 25 men. Their back was towards the temple. Ezekiel is watching them. He's probably standing behind them. In other words, what this interpretation might mean is that these 25 men farted in Ezekiel's face. Well, on that disgusting note, we have now finished Ezekiel chapter 8, and we are prepared to go to Ezekiel chapter 9. Which I will entitle Idolaters Are Killed. I hope you stay tuned for that bloody chapter, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion of chapter 8.